Saturday, August 14th, 2021. Abaigiri. About 3 weeks, roughly 3 weeks, almost 3 weeks into the Vasa period. We're doing our Vinaya classes. We've done five Vinaya classes so far, going over the Bhikkhu's training rules. There's also a number of birthdays at this time, a number of Leos, both in this monastery and our wider community. Tomorrow is Ajahn Kurunadamo's birthday, and then the day after that is Ajahn Sudanto's birthday. So, contemplating aging. And aging and death are very interesting because there's something inside of us where we don't want it that way. We kind of don't fully accept it normally. So there's something inside of us, well, it's not quite right, or we just kind of set it aside or push it aside. So either we don't want to accept it or we don't want to look at it. So the Buddha has this teaching of just looking at it directly, looking at aging and death directly, looking and seeing when the gray hairs appear and acknowledging it, and looking and seeing when different things happen in the body. This is part of mindfulness of the body. And noting it, acknowledging it, training ourselves to be okay with it, and ultimately to be okay with death. And sometimes I'm just kind of blown away by the Buddha, that he would give a teaching such as this, just so ordinary, yet this is what's liberating. A teaching so simple as contemplate the 32 parts of the body, or contemplate the four elements, and something as ordinary and as here and now as that, just the body with its organs and whatever its constituents are, its earth element and its water element, the external that we see of the body, and then the internal and the different bits and pieces that make up the body, and that contemplating and reflecting on something as ordinary as this can be liberating. Or contemplating something as ordinary as aging and death can be liberating. And I remember asking Longpo Liam when there was a tragic death in the Sangha, and Longpo Liam came to Wapananachat and asking him, well, this isn't right. This person wasn't old. They were only 39 years old. There's something not right about this. It doesn't feel right. There's something off about this. And it's not normal that something like this happens. And he just said, well, it's the most normal thing in the world, actually. You don't know how you're going to die. It happens. It happens to everybody. We don't know when it's going to happen. So making it conscious. And knowing that we have this opportunity now to put our hearts in the practice and actually realize these things, gain insight into just the nature of the body. So this is the Kayagata Sati, the mindfulness of the body. And being with these things and reflecting on these things, it's very it can be very fluid. We don't need to focus in on really honing in on just one point in exclusion to everything else. So the way I tend to think of meditation now is it's always changing as to what we have to apply, what antidotes we have to apply to the mind, what sort of medicine is needed in the moment, and developing that skill in meditation. Sometimes we need to loosen up, sometimes we need to tighten up, sometimes we need to let the mind, we need to give it a big pasture to roam a little bit, and sometimes we need to rein it back in if it's spinning out on some tangent, getting really upset about something or getting full of desire for something, then the mind might be spinning out on a tangent, so we have to rein it back in. And then when we do these contemplations, what do we do it for? We do it so the mind can learn how to let go of these things. And then, so we're not doing it just for the contemplation in and of itself. We're not doing it just for the meditation in and of itself. The meditation is for letting go. And then the hope or the dream that we have and the vision for our practice is that eventually we'll train ourselves to the point where the mind will be able to let go, and then stillness, emptiness, quiet. The mind, will there be a point when the mind is just finally just quiet? It's like that Master Shu Yun, when will the mad mind stop? So it might stop temporarily. Sometimes we might get little tastes of it. But only, so the Buddha's teaching is that only with wisdom does it really stop. So the development of wisdom is important. And wisdom isn't just book knowledge. It isn't just knowing the teachings, but it's that gaining insight. So it's not that we're able to get the answer right or do things perfectly every time. It's not that there's a set manual what's going to be the right thing to do every single time in every single situation. But the wisdom is the wisdom that knows suffering. So it knows the suffering and it knows the way out of suffering. So the wisdom comes about, the panya comes about when we use the Four Noble Truths, when we see that this is suffering. So when we see that some way that we're relating to things, our whole experience of life is relational. So the way we're relating to things, are we relating to things in the way of suffering or in the way of non-suffering? So this is like the top of the hand and the palm of the hand. You turn it over. Only one way can exist at any given time. You can't have suffering and non-suffering together. It's either suffering or it's non-suffering. So with, it's either wisdom or it's delusion. It's one or the other. That was a teaching that struck me of Lungpo Ban, that really struck me was this teaching that when the mind is unawakened, when the mind still has the ignorance and the delusion, which is most of us in the world, then everything is an irritant. So when the mind still has delusion, then everything is experienced as an irritant. It's like there's a sore, and different things are coming into contact with it and it's becoming irritated. So the mind that has delusion experiences the world as an irritant. And the mind that has Dhamma experiences the world as Dhamma. So I said the mind that has delusion experiences the world as an irritant. The mind that has Dhamma experiences the world as Dhamma. Everything is Dhamma. So that's the way of suffering and the way of non-suffering. So it's good to think about, good to consider. So the path is when we try to see what this is suffering, rather than, and this is the cause of suffering. So the tanha, the craving, is the cause of suffering. So Four Noble Truths, there is suffering, and there is the cause of suffering, there's the cessation of suffering, and there's the path. So when we see that this is suffering, we see we're experiencing suffering, we're experiencing dissatisfaction, or things, or it might not be out now, dissatisfaction, but things just aren't quite right in the heart. Or it may be full-blown sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. It can be that as well. As the Buddha says in the suttas, tearing at one's hair and beating one's breast and become distraught, then it can be at that level as well. And it's difficult because we come up against this suffering, but hopefully when we're practicing, it's the type of suffering that Lompo Cha called the suffering leading to the ending of suffering. So we don't want it to be the suffering leading to more suffering. We want it to be the suffering that we have to come up against in order to develop insight, where we actually call into question our own minds. It's like we have to have a conversation with our mind. So when our mind thinks, well, this is, you know, thing, these things are a certain way, I'm right, they're wrong. You know, it's like questioning the mind, really? Is that the case? What if they're right? What if they're actually right and I'm wrong? So we don't normally do that, but that's what's necessary in the practice, to start to question the mind and really look at where we're tripping ourselves up. Because being right isn't liberating. So we can be right all the time, but we don't suffer any less. So is that very helpful? Yeah, it's good to be right. It's good to be, you know, maybe have the right answer. But is that actually leading to a lessening of suffering? You know, we can even study and gain insight into the deepest secrets of physics and the universe, but does it create less suffering? Does it lessen our suffering? So to really lessen our suffering, to really deal with that problem we have in the heart, or that thorn, I like to think of it as a thorn, a barbed thorn in the heart. You can't just pull it out in one fell swoop. It'll just rip you apart. You can't just pull it out. But it's like the image that comes to mind is like the sun dance, the Native American sun dance, where they have an eagle talon that's placed under the muscle, and they have on a rope attached to a pole, and the talon has to come out, but they can't just rip it out in one go. It just physically, it doesn't work like that. So they have to kind of, you know, gyrate back and forth and do this dance and slowly kind of work on it, and eventually it comes out after however long, a day or whatever. So I think of suffering as very much like that. It's like this thorn, and you're working it out, and it's painful. You're pulling on it little by little, and it's painful, but it'll be really great if you're able to get it out. Part of us might think, well, I'm just going to leave it in there because it's too painful to get it out. But then if it's in there, it's also, it's doing harm as well. So it's good to get it out, but it's painful to get it out. So what do? It's going to be painful either way. So we have to see the cause of suffering to start to remove that thorn as tanha, the kama tanha, the bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. That's the craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming or for annihilation. So that's the three types of craving, and we were trying to search for that balance where there actually isn't those three types of craving. And we're going to be cycling between those different types of craving in the course of the practice. So if it's not just out and out sensual desire, it's going to be craving to create, craving to do wholesome activity even is still bhava tanha, but it's, you know, it may be wholesome or unwholesome, but it's not leading to an ending of suffering. So then there's the then we swing to the vibhava tanha. We think, oh, I shouldn't do that, you know, I shouldn't be getting caught in becoming. So then we go and we swing the other way into the wanting to just be done with things, wanting to blot things out or annihilate ourselves. And so we push ourselves into that corner and we, okay, well that's the extreme of vibhava tanha. So then we cycle around those until we start to find this balance. And the balance is the third noble truth, which is the complete cessation, complete relinquishment of that craving, leading to the ending of suffering. So, but I want to look at the second noble truth, because that's where that's where the misunderstanding is, largely, I believe, is with this second noble truth. Because we don't see that these three types of tanha that are in the heart and being generated by us, ourselves, we don't see that as the cause of suffering yet. And so we really have to be conscious about how we look at this. We see that, you know, this person is the cause of my suffering. This situation is the cause of my suffering. You know, this political situation is the cause of my suffering. This disease is the cause of my suffering. This friend is the cause of my suffering. This relative is the cause of my suffering. We don't see. And that's where the heart is actually at. So, and then that's what we're trying to change. We're running around trying to change those things, thinking that that's the cause of suffering. So it comes from that misunderstanding, and the energy then is misguided, rather than kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, those things that are in the heart that are the cause of suffering. It doesn't mean we don't try to make the world a better place in various ways. We can do that, and not saying to not do that. But in terms of suffering, in terms of lessening suffering, and actually doing it according to the Buddha's way, that's the looking at the tanha directly. And that's very empowering. That's very empowering, because then we can actually do something about it. You know, if we couldn't stop suffering until we changed all the bad people in the world, that would be just terrible. We'd never be able to stop. Then it would be impossible. It'd be impossible that we stop suffering, because we can always, without end, we can always be changing external situations. The other insidious thing about craving that's kind of hard to see, but it's good to really make it conscious and look at it, is that craving is never satisfied. So part of us might think too, okay, well I see that the craving is leading to the suffering, but if I fulfill that craving, then I won't suffer. So if I fulfill the craving enough, then the craving will go away and I won't suffer. But that's also a trick of craving, because craving by its very nature is craving. So it's tricking us into, we might have just the most briefest relief if we say give into a craving or we indulge a craving, but then because craving is craving by its very nature, it's that same energy is still there. so the craving doesn't actually go away by fulfilling it, and it's still there, and it might even grow stronger actually when it's fed. It's like a tiger that when it's fed, it actually grows stronger. So then it needs more and more, and it keeps growing stronger the more we feed it. So that's another difficulty in the practice. What do we do with that? Do we just not eat? Do we just not fulfill any cravings? And that's not the way either, because we have to eat, we have to live. So we have these reflections on physical food, physical nutriment. I eat alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for putting on bulk. Only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, for helping with the holy life, so I can keep practicing. Thinking thus, I will lay hunger without overeating. So it doesn't mean not eating, but it means looking at it in a very balanced way, taking what we need. And the Buddha's not even saying, don't enjoy your food, because you can... When you have less craving for food, it's a strange paradox that you'll actually enjoy it more. It's more enjoyable in the moment. If there's a lot of craving for food, then when we're taking one bite, the craving's looking at the next bite, and it goes through the whole meal that way. So it's actually not as enjoyable. So that's the paradox, or the crate without craving, there's actually more enjoyment, more happiness, more contentment, more of a sense of ease and well-being, less suffering. So we study the monastic rules at this time. A lot of these monastic rules, well, all of them actually, the whole Vinaya, all of the discipline that we follow, and even the non-monastic rules, the 8 precepts, the 5 precepts, and so on, these are all for getting us to see this more clearly. It's all for seeing the Four Noble Truths. So the precepts are helping us with that. The monks actually have a precept to not use money, and that's incredibly helpful. You know, we can't just purchase something if we want it. So we have to look at the want. We have to look at the wanting instead. So if we want something and we can't get it, how much do we suffer over that? So we have to look at the wanting directly. And the whole monastic schedule, living in the monastery, you can't just go to the refrigerator in the afternoon and make a sandwich, for example, something that's totally normal. But it's like, oh, in the afternoon, I'm hungry, I want a sandwich. I can't just go into the kitchen and open the refrigerator. Or I want some, that ice cream that was out today, I want some of that in the afternoon. I can't just go and do that. It's something that would be totally normal. But having to look at that, so that really keeps that edge of the practice going. That's the blessing of having the monastic form, the monastic schedule, living in a monastery, having a set of standards, agreed upon standards that people are following. So it's quite a blessing to be able to practice in this way. And it's amazing, actually, that groups of people actually devote their lives to living in this way. And the effect is, you gain more insight into that, how that craving works, and then you get more and more contentment, well-being. The heart starts to cool down. So you're getting that thorn out little by little. And perhaps it's thinner and thinner, so there's less and less of it in there. That's really, really glad I'm starting to get that thorn out. Really, this is really great. And thinking about those who have come before us, who have done this, the great disciples of the Buddha, and then up to the present day with Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, and this is the Sangha Nusati, recollection of Sangha, recollection of the community that exists. So we have this support for this practice. Without the support, there's not much we could do. If we struck out on our own, we could try to practice for a while, but it's unlikely that we would get very far. The craving would come in and it'd just be back to square one. So we have this ability with the Sangha, with the community of practitioners, we have that ability to support and encourage each other. That's incredibly important. That helps us to really get through those low periods. When we live our life with precepts, there'll be daily, weekly, monthly, annually, there's going to be low periods that maybe we're going to want to, we just don't want to deal with things for a while. We don't want to deal with things anymore. We want to take a break. So there'd be these low periods, but with the Sangha, then there's a lot of support to get through those low periods, those low spots. It happens for everybody. And we might think, I just want to take a break. You know, we do these two-week retreats, solitary retreats during the Vasa period. So in a couple days, it'll change over to another group doing the two-week retreat. And I think, get a break, do this two-week retreat. But then we go on to retreat, and there's just no break. The thorn is still there. The mind is still there. There's just no break. There's no breaks in samsara. The only break is nibbana. So there's no vacation. There's no break. No matter how bad we want to take a break, it's just not going to happen. So we just have to keep practicing. It's all there is to it. It is good to change things up sometimes. Maybe we're overworked, we could take a break in that way, but still the mind is there, still the defilements are there, still the heart is there, so we still have to be careful, we still have to be developing the mindfulness of the body, we still have to be contemplating the elements, we still have to be practicing with the food and with craving. Or we might even think, well, you know, maybe okay, I can't get to Nibbana, so maybe just if I was just gonna, at least I could go to a heavenly realm and then I would have a break. So if I get reborn in a heavenly realm, then it'll be so nice and that'll be my break. But even then, even devas don't get breaks. So even devas they're still bound by craving and attachment, and even though their experience is incredibly blissful, they're still seeking after things. And I think, okay, well, but that's the sense sphere devas. So I might, what if I'm reborn as a Brahma god? And then I'll get a break. So, but then also they also fall from their state eventually. So Nibbana is the only break. it's maybe an unfortunate truth. We might not even want to hear that. And there's these uncompromising teachings in the suttas. And it's good to not get too heavy about it also. If we're practicing and we're in it for the long haul, then it's good to be able to laugh at oneself and not get too heavy, too kind of like judging of oneself that we're not there yet. This is a long process, and there's a sutta that says the Buddha saying, apart from letting go of all, relinquishing all, you know, apart from insight into craving and letting go of everything. Apart from that, I do not see any safety for beings. So that the Buddha is pointing directly to that final goal, that final place of safety. So that's Wupassama Anusati, that's the recollection of peace. And it's good to do. It's good to think about Nibbana and think about peace and consider what is it and what is it in the heart that's blocking me from that, and then looking directly at that. And also seeing like how can we empower ourselves to relate to life being a relational process? How do we relate to life in a way that's more conducive to liberation, conducive to freedom and letting go of attachment, and conducive to a sense of ease and well-being, and conducive to a lessening of suffering? How can I relate in a way that facilitates that? So I'll leave that for a reflection this evening.